We are talking today with Joseph Stiglitz. Joseph Stiglitz is a university professor at Columbia University in New York and chair of Columbia University's Committee on Global Thought. In 2001, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics for his analysis of markets with asymmetric information. Joseph Stiglitz was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors from 1993 to 1995 during the Clinton administration and served as CEA chairman from 1995 to 1997. He then became chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank from 1997 to 2000. He founded one of the leading economic journals, the Journal of Economic Perspectives. He has written numerous books as well as textbooks, including Globalization and Its Discontents, which has been translated into 35 languages, The Roaring Nineties, Towards a New Paradigm in Monetary Economics, which he co-authored with Bruce Greenwald, and Fair Trade for All, which he co-authored with Andrew Charlton. And he's here to talk about his new book, Making Globalization Work. Joseph Stiglitz, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Always nice to be here.
If you'd begin, tell us the motivation for writing your new book.
Well, a lot has happened since my last book, Globalization and Its Discontents. Perspectives on globalization have changed. The world has changed. The rise of China is an important global power. In addition, in my earlier book, I hadn't had time to analyze a number of aspects of globalization. I was right after I left the World Bank, and I focused more on the World Bank, the IMF, the international financial institutions. Globalization embraces almost every aspect of our society, of our economy, and so there are many other important areas: trade, intellectual property, natural resources, the environment. It seemed to me that it was important to expand the debate into those other areas. And finally, in my earlier book, I focused on the problems, the discontent with globalization. My wife said, you know, you've complained enough. Why don't you give us some answers? So that motivated me to try to think hard about what we could do to make globalization work better. So the book really has a lot of proposals, some small, some large, some that can be accomplished in the short run, some that are actually already happening, some that will take, admittedly, a long time to come about. But unless we begin to talk about these things, there won't be the changes that we need.
All right. Maybe you could give us a quick definition of globalization for those that aren't familiar.
Globalization is basically the closer integration of the countries of the world. Economic globalization is the closer integration of the economies of the world, result of lowering of transportation costs, communication costs, and the lowering of a lot of the man-made barriers to the movements of goods, services, capital, people across borders. But of course, there are many other dimensions to globalization. There's globalization of knowledge. Knowledge flows more freely. Globalization of ideas, important ideas like democracy and human rights, also are moving across borders. And then there's a globalized civil society. Movements like the anti-globalization movement itself is part of globalization.
All right. So talk about the different areas that you focus on in your book, maybe starting with the whole concept of trade, free trade, which is, if you catch the corporate media, it sounds like there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. You'd be crazy not to want to support free trade.
That's right. In fact, one of the oldest ideas in economics, Adam Smith talked about how expanding markets allows people to take advantage of their comparative advantage, the strength and their each country's strength, and therefore increase incomes. The problem, there are actually several problems. The first of it is that even traditional theory, well-managed trade, says that there are going to be winners, but there are also going to be losers. It says that the winners could compensate the losers. That is to say, the country as a whole is better off, but it never said that they would compensate the losers. So one of the problems of free trade, if we really had it, is that there are some people who will actually be worse off. Unfortunately, globalization is often used as an excuse to lower social protections and thus exacerbate the underlying economic forces. But the other problem is we don't really have free trade. Everybody talks about it, but nobody really means it. America talks about free trade, but we keep our subsidies, our cotton subsidies, for instance, $3 to $4 billion going to 25,000 very well-off cotton farmers, 10 million poor cotton farmers in sub-Saharan Africa are pushed as a result below subsistence or further have their income reduced. That's not free trade, and it's certainly not fair trade. Actually, if you had a free trade agreement, it'd be relatively short. A couple pages. We eliminate our tariffs, they eliminate theirs. We eliminate our non-tariff barriers, they eliminate theirs. We eliminate our subsidies, they eliminate theirs. Trade agreements go on for thousands of pages. Their intent is not free trade, it's to open up other countries to our exports, but not open up our markets to theirs. What happens is, because the United States and the EU are the rich and more powerful countries, they write the rules of the game. And they write the rules of the game for their own advantage, or more accurately, for the advantage of their special interest within their country. And the result of this is that not just that the richest countries get the lion's share of the gains. Everybody expected that. But the poorest countries are actually made worse off. That's what happened in the Oregon round, the round that happened in 93, completed in 94. And that was why one of the reasons why there were protests here in Seattle. The developing countries said, another round of trade agreements is going to make us even worse off. And no agreement is better than another unfair trade agreement like the last one.
So why then are these countries that are basically the losers in these negotiations, why are they continuing in this?
Well, what happened after the Seattle protests, I've been told not to say Seattle riots, after the Seattle protests in November of 2001 in Doha, a place where less conducive to open demonstrations, there was an agreement. The advanced industrial countries promised the developing countries that they would rectify the imbalances of the past. They would make up for what the deficiencies of the past. They would make up for the broken promises of the past. And they called it even a development round. I was actually very excited because when I had been chief economist of the World Bank, I had gone to Geneva in March of 1999 and said, look at you guys, this is what you did last time. This is where you went wrong. This is how you disadvantage the developing countries. This is why this agreement has had such a negative effect. And in Seattle, this is what you ought to be correcting. They didn't pay any attention. And one of the reasons why there were the protests is that they hadn't paid any attention. Well, in Doha, they said, we'll make this a development round. I think they actually never intended to fulfill those promises. But whether they intended or not, they very quickly reneged on those promises. And so what has happened in the years since then is increasingly it has not been a development round. Increasingly it was the developed countries doing the same old thing they had done before, repackaging some of the things that they were doing before and calling it a development round. But it wasn't. And by the time 2 years, 3 years were up, at the time of Cancun in 2003, it was clear that it really didn't deserve to be called a development round. Well, the Cancun, the meeting in Cancun, September 2003, the developing countries walked out. They said, this isn't going anywhere. And that meeting ended in a debacle. A little bit later in Hong Kong, in just last December, in December of 2005, what had happened is they lowered expectations. They said, well, we'll be a little bit less ambitious, but at least we'll do something. But it turned out that the trade ministers, the U.S. trade representative, put more energy into spinning the story than into making a good agreement. Some of the things they did were literally unbelievable. I mean, for instance, let me give you an example. The United States said that we'll open up our markets to 97% of the goods of the least developed countries. Europe had already opened itself up to 100% of the goods of the least developed countries, where basically they said everything but arms. 97% sounds pretty good. It sounds 97% of the way towards 100%, but it's not really that. It's an initiative that I started calling the EBP, Everything But What You Produce. Bangladesh, a very poor country, can export without tariffs freely, jet engines, airplanes, everything that they don't produce. When it comes to the things they do produce, textiles, apparel, That's where the restrictions bind. So in that 3% is 100% of what Cambodia produces and about 60% of what Bangladesh produces. So it's not only that there is this unfair trade agreement, it's a statement of hypocrisy and a clear sense of dissembling, dishonesty, which has done, I think, us so much damage all over the world.
So I know you began with telling us that you have solutions for these different aspects. How would you fix that particular one? Just make it 100%?
Well, that one, make it 100%, exactly. But they're actually, even short of that, there are a lot of things that we could do that would help other developing countries. This was an area that was focused on the poorest countries. It was an important principle, though. In the past, trade negotiations have been based on reciprocity. We give up this, you give us that. Reciprocity makes a great deal of sense when you're talking about relatively equals, EU, United States. Reciprocity doesn't make any sense at all when you're dealing with the United States and Bangladesh, United States and some poor African country. There can't be reciprocity on a level playing field. And so this particular initiative that Europe pushed very strongly was one that I thought was a basic principle, a very important principle, that we ought to recognize that the poor are in a different position. We're willing to give them aid. We've committed ourselves to giving 0.7% of our GDP in aid. We haven't lived up to that. We're only giving about one-fifth of that, 0.15% of our GDP in aid. But we've committed ourselves to giving 0.7%. But if they're willing to give them money, why don't we give them opportunity? Opportunity to produce things, opportunity that we would buy these things. Now, we would be better off because we would be getting these things cheaper than we currently get. So it would be a win-win. Our consumers are better off. The poorest people in the world are better off. A few producers in the United States might suffer a little bit. But even then, it's so small that we could clearly absorb the shock. But there are lots of other things that we ought to be doing. One of the things I point out, while the Doha round, development round, got bogged down in the context of agriculture, there are a broad other agenda that would make a very big difference to developing countries. For instance, one important issue is manufacturing. We design our tariffs to stop industrialization of these countries. We allow them, for instance, in some cases, to export their raw materials with relatively low tariffs, but if they want to export processed foods, they face very high tariffs. So what we're doing is really taxing, putting on tariff, extraordinarily high tariff, on the processing itself. We don't want them to be engaged in processing. We want the processing to be done in the north. What we're doing is stopping industrialization and development. So it's like we actually got down and figured out, now how can we stop their development? Again, it's an example. We call it a development round, but we haven't done anything to try to actually promote their development. So that's another example of both the hypocrisy and where there actually is a rich agenda that could make really provide new opportunities for these countries. Another example I talk about is access to life-saving medicines. One of the important provisions in the last round was called TRIPS, Trade-Related Intellectual Property. It wasn't trade-related. It was called trade-related because they had to say that to put it in a trade agreement. There already was a World Intellectual Property Organization that was dealing with these problems. But the trade ministers, representing their companies from the advanced industrial countries, wanted this to be put in a trade agreement, so they called it a TRIPS. Well, the most influential industry in all of this was the pharmaceuticals. They had a simple objective. Their objective was to kill off, to suppress the generic medicine industry. Why are these generics so important? Well, generics are usually 5-10% of the price of the brand name. Take the AIDS medicines. A year treatment of the for these AIDS medicines, the cocktails, generics, around $300 or less. Brand name, around $10,000. If your income is $300 a year or even $3,000 a year, you can't afford $10,000. You might be able, with some help, to afford $300. So, in effect, when those trade ministers signed that trade agreement in Marrakesh, the spring of 1994, they were signing the death warrants of thousands of people in sub-Saharan Africa, and elsewhere in the developing countries, that would no longer have access to these life-saving medicines at prices that they could afford. Now, if the developing countries got something out of this, that might make sense. Of course, you know, we have to fund research. Research doesn't come for free. But what did they get out of it? What did they get in return for the high price? Well, do the pharmaceutical industries do any research related to the diseases of the developing countries? No. They spend more on marketing and advertising than they do on research, more on research on lifestyle drugs like hair or other things like that than they do on life-saving drugs. And almost all of the money on life-saving drugs goes to the drugs, diseases, for the advanced industrial countries, not for malaria diseases that affect hundreds of millions of people. So they paid the price, but they haven't gotten the benefits that you would have expected. So one of the points that I try to, you know, in this area, you know, how to fix it, is to say one of the ways that we can really help the developing countries is to promote research for the diseases that are affecting the developing countries. And the patent system is not really a very good way of doing that particular issue. It's very good in some other issues, but not on that issue. Why? Because the way the patent system works is to give monopoly power. Monopoly power generates profits by restricting use and raising prices. That means we have knowledge that could save lives that we're not using. And that doesn't make any sense. It's neither fair nor efficient nor morally justified. There's another system that I describe, which is the medical prize fund, where we say, look, let's identify some diseases that are really important, like malaria. And if you come up with a vaccine against malaria, come up with a cure for malaria or something that really reduces its effects, we'll give you a big prize. Then we use the market. We'll use the competitive market to find the least cost way of delivering this to the most people that we can. We use the efficiency of a competitive market, not the inefficiency of monopoly. So it really changes around the whole logic of healthcare delivery and healthcare innovation. We are going to be paying for innovations in one way or another. It's just that the current system is perverse. It doesn't give us the incentive to develop the medicines that we need and are important for helping many people, and it has incentives to restrict the usage of the knowledge after we discover it rather than maximize the usage of that knowledge.
So when you're saying the we in these negotiations that took place, are you talking about the U.S. or Western countries or both?
Both. In some areas, the U.S. has taken, quote, the leadership. And, you know, I saw it very clearly that a U.S. trade representative is very attentive to the interests of the entertainment industry, the drug industries, the big lobby groups that, you know, invest millions of dollars in campaign contributions. And they make those investments expecting a return, you know, just like they make an investment in any machines or any other kind of investment. It happens to be, I think, the investment from which they get the highest rate of return.
And as you just pointed out, it's my perception that, again, the U.S. trade representatives are going to bat for these corporations, and it's implied somehow that we as U.S. citizens are getting, you know, some fruit of this, but it doesn't appear that when you look at the bottom line that we're getting anything on this. In fact, it sounds like we're subsidizing as taxpayers.
Exactly. In many cases, we are actually losing. Now, I think if you put it as a moral issue to Americans, do you think that the poorest people in the world should have access to life-saving medicines? We have the knowledge. Should we make it available to them? I think most Americans would say yes. You know, we don't want people to die unnecessarily. But in the case of the drug companies, what is even more astounding is that they arrange their affairs so they often don't pay the taxes they ought to pay. So we're working for them. The U.S. government is working for them, trying to get an agreement that maximizes their income at the cost of suffering and elsewhere in the world. But they don't even make their full share of the contributions. They use a whole variety of mechanisms for transferring income out of the United States, putting it in places that are where they don't have to pay taxes, avoiding taxes in one way or another. To me, it's astounding that we work so hard for some people who are contributing so little.
And how do you propose to deal with the basic system from the standpoint of the people that are making all this money and significant quantities of it? I don't think they're going to be up for wanting to change the system quite the way you've proposed it. So what are the incentives that are going to make them agree to, for instance, give up their intellectual property grip?
Well, you raise a very important question. A number of the critics in my book have said, you know, I'm a little bit a utopian. I've described the important role of special interest in shaping globalization today. Why do I think a lecture or even writing a book is going to make a difference? Well, let me tell you why. I think that there are a number of forces already at play that mean that globalization is going to change. It is changing. One of the reasons I wrote the book is because it's changing. For instance, go back a little bit to the area of subsidies of cotton that I talked about, agricultural subsidies. The Uruguay agreement was a very unfair agreement, the agreement that was signed in 1994. But it had one good thing, and that was it was the beginning of a rule of law. And the reason why you have a rule of law is that it creates a framework in which the big and powerful can't just get what they want. Very important, and we talk about it all the time. Sometimes we don't really live up to what we say. Well, the WTO has ruled that the U.S. cotton subsidies are illegal. That means they're eventually going to go. We'll appeal, we'll try to change the form of the subsidy to make comply with the letter of the law, but not the spirit of it. They'll rule that that is illegal. It's going to be a long while. It'll be a lot nicer if we did it more quickly, more gracefully, without creating as many enemies. But they will go. Take another aspect. I mentioned that 25,000 cotton farmers, 10,000 rice farmers, very relatively few people in agriculture are getting these enormous benefits, and effectively have put a major roadblock in another international agreement. Well, there are a lot of export industries in the United States that would benefit from another agreement. Boeing here in Seattle is an important export industry. Financial services, New York, is an important export industry. We have a lot of export industries that can compete on a level playing field, and they want another agreement. They realize that seldom have so few done so much damage to so many in creating in a world a sense of hypocrisy where America isn't living up to its ideals. So they've become an important interest group trying to countervail some of the other interest groups. We won't get another agreement as unfair as the last agreement, partly because the developing countries have woken up, partly because there are growing democracies in these other countries, growing civil societies, who say, look, we are not going to sign another agreement. If you come back with another agreement like that, you're out. You're out of office. And politicians respond to that. So the reality is that we can't get another unfair agreement, and so it makes much more sense for us to try to work for a more fair agreement that recognizes the concerns of the developing countries. That's the new global political reality. And there's a third, I think, very important force in much of the world, and I think it's actually happening gradually in the United States, and that is a consciousness that we live in one world, that what goes on in one part of the world affects all of us. It is an aspect of globalization. We see the face of poverty on our television every day. We see children suffering from malnutrition. We understand what is going on. We know that 40% of the world lives under $2 a day. Before, these facts of life weren't hitting us in the way that they have been more recently. In Europe, the result of this is a very strong global social justice movement. I've been invited over a number of times recently to talk to the British Parliament, groups in the British Parliament. The largest all-party group focuses on aid, debt, and trade to the developing countries. I asked one of the members of Parliament, you know, why is this such a big issue? And their answer was, because our citizens care about it. For them, it's become a defining issue. They want us to do something about the problem of the poor countries. That's why the British government was very active in trying to get debt relief. It was one of the top issues on their agenda when they were leading the G8. So these issues have become issues of intense voter concern in many democracies in the advanced industrial countries. And that's one of the reasons why I think increasingly something will happen in the way globalization is managed, to understand that as we live in a world, we will have to create a fair form of globalization.
So do you think the World Trade Organization, the WTO, should be reformed or modified or dissolved?
Oh, clearly the issue of globalization is that we are more interdependent. We deal with each other constantly in ways that we didn't have to before. And when there is that high degree of interdependence, there has to be rules, regulations, there have to be ways of acting collectively together. The problem is we haven't had the democratic institutions and the mindsets to do this effectively and fairly. So the answer is very clearly we have to move in a direction to make these more democratic, more transparent, more accountable. And there have been reforms. What is going on today is better than it was, say, 15 years ago. One of the reasons that we are so much aware of the problems today is globalization, and because it's more out in the open. These issues weren't being discussed before. Now they're very much on the table. So that's a step in the right direction, but it's clearly a small step, and we have to do more. It's still the case that the poorest developing countries are not really at the bargaining table. One could understand it because as part of the global trading system, they're very small. In the United States, the EU, you say, well, only the big players should be at the table. They've admitted basically big players like India and Brazil into the table. But their interests may not coincide with that of the poorest countries of the world. And while the poorest countries of the world are small in terms of the impact on global trade, they are impacted by global trade in a very important way. Their livelihoods depend on it. And so just because they aren't the big players doesn't mean their voices shouldn't be heard. And unfortunately, in recent years, even with all the reforms, their voices haven't been heard in the way that they should be.
All right. Unfortunately, we're running short on time. What final thoughts would you like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I think this last thought is really very related to one of the most important points that I raised in the book, and that is that economic globalization has outpaced political globalization. We've become more interdependent, but we don't have the political institutions, the mindsets, to deal with the full consequences of globalization. Too often, the result of this is that the way we think about justice, fairness, stops at the border. We worry about efficiency and equity inside the country. But outside, when we tell our trade minister, when you tell the U.S. Trade Representative, when he goes to Geneva, we don't say come back with a fair trade agreement. He'd be fired. What we say is come back with the best agreement for America. And, of course, what we really mean is come back with the best agreement for our big campaign contributors. Well, clearly, if we're going to make globalization work, this has to change. The only way it's going to change is if there's more democratic participation in the process. The multinational corporations get it. They understand the importance of these rules, of how the rules are written for their profits. And that's why they take an active role in shaping the globalization, and that's the reason it's been shaped the way it is. In our democracies, we've actively taken a role of trying to countervail the role of these special interests. Some states have actually gone so far as to try to curtail campaign contributions, to try to make the whole process more open. But we haven't fully done this across the board. And so the reason I wrote the book is to bring these issues down to hopefully to have more citizens, more Americans understand what is going on so that they can act as a countervailing force, a democratic countervailing force to the role of the special interests that have had the sole hand in shaping globalization. My view is it's the only way we're going to make globalization work, or at least work better, so that the kinds of promises that were made about globalization, the benefits that were promised, will be realized, and that globalization will not only make a few people in the rich countries better off, make most people in both the developed and the developing countries better off.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
Just been talking with Joseph Stiglitz, author of the new book, Making Globalization Work.